Back to Matthew chapter 27. If you ever go to Washington, D.C., some of you have been there. Some of you have plans to go there. But if you ever make it that way, you might find the Department of Justice, where you'll notice a window. There's a lot of windows in that building. But there's one in particular with an engraving above it that says, "Where law ends, tyranny begins." When law ceases, when there's no more rules, that's precisely the point at which tyranny begins. Now, what's tyranny? Tyranny is an illicit use of power and control over somebody else with a level of cruelty and oppression that's unauthorized by law or justice and not required at all for the purpose of government. That's what tyranny is. So by dictionary definition, what we have before us this morning in Matthew chapter 27 is tyranny. Tyranny. Law has ended. We've been reading about that. Justice has been violated, repeatedly ignored. They're breaking all their own laws to get Christ tried and condemned. And so what's happened now is tyranny. Tyranny has ensued. Why? Because the law has ended. And so now everything that we're about to read this morning is what happens when God places himself into the hands of angry tyrants. Reading again in verse 27, it says that the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. Now, there are a couple of groups here mentioned. One is the soldiers of the governor. These would have been non-Roman soldiers that were hired out by the government from the surrounding area, mostly Syrians. They were non-Jews, and they didn't appreciate or admire the Jews any more than the Romans did, so they served a good purpose as soldiers, but they weren't technically Romans themselves. The garrison was. So the soldiers of the governor might have been Syrian, but they gathered the whole garrison around Jesus. The whole garrison, that would have been the Roman soldiers. And a garrison would have been 1/10 of a legion of soldiers. So that tells us the number of soldiers that were gathered around Jesus. You don't just have the soldiers of the governor there, but you've also got this garrison. A legion was 6,000 soldiers. A garrison being 1/10 then would be 600 soldiers. So there are, just to give you an idea of what was going on there, 600 plus individuals all gathered around Jesus. And in verse 28, it says they stripped him. What that means is naked. According to R.T. France, one commentary, he says that it was normal for criminals to be stripped of their clothes before crucifixion. So there's Jesus. No clothes on. So I want you to understand as we get into the narrative this morning about crucifixion, that crucifixion was the most painful way to die, but it was more than just the pain. It wasn't just the painful way, it was also the most embarrassing. And so there's Jesus standing there buck naked. Public nudity would have added another layer to his suffering. Completely stripped of all of his clothes, in front of 600 strangers, which that's a nightmare for some of us, isn't it? You ever had that one? Where you're naked in public? I might be the only one. They say sometimes it's just a fear of public speaking, so you can understand then why I'd have constant dreams of being naked in front of everybody. I'm just glad that I'm wearing a shirt today. So at any rate, the idea here is that Jesus is not only about to feel even greater pain than he's already felt by being scourged, he's also being embarrassed and disgraced and humiliated and all the rest. So going on in verse 28, they stripped him, and then they put a scarlet robe on him. So it's not that he's without clothes, but just so you know, this scarlet robe was no adequate covering for a naked man. This would have been part of the Roman soldier's uniform that was actually a very short sort of overcoat, didn't go down very far at all. The fact that it was scarlet, another gospel writer says it was purple. It's been suggested that it was actually faded. So, you know, it started as one color, but it was so old and faded that it turned into this. And so the idea is that they just took some secondhand, goodwill find and put it on him. They're just trying to make him look like an absolute idiot. And it's working. Jesus just looks like a dumb fool. And that's what they want. They're mocking him. They're going to taunt him. They twisted a crown of thorns, it says, and they put it on his head to mock the emperor, to mimic the emperor's crown. But of course, they're not treating him like an emperor. They put a reed in his right hand to represent the scepter, the symbol of power that the Roman emperor would carry. And for Jesus, it's a dried stick and a crown of thorns and a scarlet robe. And then they all bowed their knee before him and mocked him and said, "Hail, King of the Jews," you know. "Hail, King of the Jews." And then they spit on him. And they took the reed, grabbed it out of his hand, apparently, and started to beat him on the head with it. And it's not a light, polite smack. This is, right? So they're inflicting great pain on top of a man who's already suffered great pain. When they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes back on, and led him away to be crucified. Now, I want you to consider the picture here. You remember that Jesus has already been scourged. Okay, look at verse 26. That's the verse we left off on last week. It says that the governor released Barabbas, and then he had Jesus scourged. Now, scourging was quite a process, and these are going to be details that some of us are familiar with, if we're familiar at all with the crucifixion. Maybe you've seen the movie, The Passion of the Christ, and so we kind of understand this, but scourging was what took place before crucifixion. It was meant to extract a confession from the criminal, okay? You make the beating severe enough, maybe they'll start telling the truth. And so Jesus was scourged. That means he was whipped over and over with an instrument that was braided leather straps that had broken pieces of glass or pottery, sharp metal, broken bone woven into the strips so that when it was brought across the back of a condemned criminal, it would lacerate, it would shred. Oftentimes, these individuals undergoing scourging would be flayed to the bone. So bones are being exposed. Underlying tissues are coming to the surface, muscle tissue, veins, arteries. Sometimes the strips would wrap around because they're getting whipped in the back, but they're long enough to wrap around to the front and tear apart the abdomen. Sometimes the bowels would start to leak out. You can understand how severe this was. It was oftentimes enough to kill victims before they even got to the cross, so they would die there on the scourging floor. At this point, I'm just trying to give you a picture of what Jesus looked like. He's terribly swollen. The natural bodily reactions to this having occurred would have been to swell profusely. I would say that Jesus is less conscious than he was before. You know, he's probably losing consciousness, maybe dipping out in and out of delirium. Isaiah 52, verse 14, gives us a better description, saying that Jesus was, quote, so disfigured he didn't look like a man, he didn't even resemble a human being, end quote. So you couldn't tell what it was. Not who it was, you couldn't tell what it was. I always say he looked more like hamburger than a human. Jesus is at this point probably convulsing, gasping for air, likely. He's probably vomiting all over himself. That's the picture we have of Christ. And I want to point out the fact that instead of evoking sympathy among the crowd, the 600 plus that are watching, instead of evoking sympathy among them, it generates laughter, jesting, mockery. It produces in them verbal taunting and physical abuse, the cruelest of treatments. That's remarkable. How cold and hard-hearted have you become that you could watch something, whether man or beast, suffer so terribly and laugh at it? But that's exactly what's happening. And Jesus is the recipient of that torture. And I'll tell you this, and you know it's true. One of the things that a human being craves most in times of great suffering like this is pity. If you've ever been on the receiving end of any kind of cruelty, whether it be physical or verbal or anything else, you want pity, especially in situations where you know that relief is unattainable. They're not going to stop the abuse. It's not going to happen. And you just want nothing more than for someone to come alongside of you and offer a little bit of consolation. Maybe there's somebody near us who cares enough to feel sorry, just to feel sorry for me. It might be a mild consolation, but boy, it feels nice in a situation like that. It's what Jesus wanted. Did you know that? Bible tells us that Jesus wanted pity, and he gets none. Nothing. 600 plus people who could have offered it, and he doesn't get it from a single individual. How do I know that Jesus wanted pity so much? Well, one, because when we're in situations like that, we want it. It's natural. But I wouldn't rely on experience alone, my own human experience. The Bible tells me that Jesus wanted pity. In Psalm 69, which is very prophetic, it says in verse 20, quote, "Their insults have broken my heart. I'm in despair. If only one person would show some pity. If only one would turn and comfort me." That's what Psalm 69, verse 20 says, and it's prophetic, looking forward to the day that Jesus would be scourged, that Jesus would be mocked, that Jesus would be tortured, and Jesus would be crucified. These are the words that he would think and speak. These are the words that Jesus felt. He wanted pity from just one person. He wanted consolation just from one, and out of hundreds, he got none. And isn't it interesting in that very verse where it says, their insults have broken my heart. So apparently, their taunts hurt Jesus worse than their whips. There's nothing in Psalm 69 about their whips have ripped my skin. Their fists have bruised my face. He's not talking about the physical aspects. He says, their insults have broken my heart. What hurts Jesus worse than sticks and stones? His words. Those of you who are unfamiliar with the saying, we have a little rhyme as children that we speak when we're little in America. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Words will never hurt me. You heard that one. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but nothing you say is going to hurt me. That ain't true. Guys, words hurt. Oftentimes, words hurt worse than sticks and stones and reeds and whips and thorns. Jesus knew it. His heart was broken by them. How patient Jesus was in his suffering. He's demonstrating amazing patience here, amazing levels of meekness and humility. And I tell you that the true seal of Christ-likeness in a man or woman isn't just how much good you can do for other people. Sometimes we think that that's the hallmark of a Christian, is somebody who does nice things for people, does good things for people. That's part of it, but the true mark of Christ-likeness is how steadfast you remain in your faith no matter how much evil others do to you. Not just how much good you can do for people, but how much evil you can tolerate from them and how patient and steadfast you remain, like Jesus did, in your faith through that suffering. That's what Jesus did, and that's what we as Christians aim for. In verse 32, it says, as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene. That would have been in northern Africa. Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear Jesus' cross. This is a very interesting bit of text. Very short, but we're introduced to a man who was forced to carry Jesus' cross. That was not uncommon for those that were bound to crucifixion. The condemned that were to be crucified were forced to carry their own crossbeam through the city to the site of their execution. So it was, I think, more common that they would be carrying just the crossbeam. The upright of the crucifix would have been in a fixed location at the site of execution. the crossbeam they were forced to carry, and they would follow a trajectory through the city in order to be seen. It was always very public, and I'll talk more about that in a second. But a typical crossbeam would have weighed roughly 100 pounds, and that's a heavy burden to bear. The route that Jesus took, nonetheless, was between one-third and one-half mile in length. In yards, it was 650. So 650 yards, carrying 100 pounds on his back. He's already near death. This would have killed many others, but Jesus is still alive, tripping his way through the city, that 650-yard route. He's stopping along the way. He's getting to the point where he's physically unable to get there on his own. So somebody needed to assist him. Simon by name. So in this verse, we're introduced to a man who, it's crazy that he's even in the Bible. It's crazy that Jesus was so weak that he couldn't make it to the cross. So this is a detail in Scripture that I find has the potential in our minds to sort of lessen or cheapen the effort that Jesus made to die for our sins. It almost seems like he didn't do as much as he could have or should have done. He needed help? Well, what's this that Jesus needed help? It almost seems to cheapen the whole thing, and it makes you wonder if this made his sacrifice less than perfect. Right? Because a hero shouldn't need anybody's help. A savior like ours shouldn't need that. He should do it all himself. But no, I'm here to tell you that the help Simon offered Jesus in carrying the crossbeam doesn't in any way diminish Christ's work on the cross or his effort to get there. If anything, it clarifies the fact that Jesus literally gave everything that he had. The reason somebody else had to help him carry the crossbeam was because Jesus had nothing left to give. He gave you and me his all. He had no strength left to expend. There was nothing in him because he'd already used all of it. It was gone. Every last ounce of what Jesus had was gone. So what does that say to us? It says he held nothing back. Jesus held nothing back, gave everything to get himself to the one and only place on earth where he could intercept the wrath of God for us. And that was at what's called Golgotha, the place of the skull, the execution site. Jesus knows he has to get there because that's where God's wrath is going to be poured out. That's where I need to intercept it so it doesn't fall on you and you and you and you and you. Jesus is determined to get there and can't. And so God, his Father, steps in and causes this Simon from Cyrene to pick up the cross and help him get there. Believe me, Jesus is determined and willing, but his flesh is weak and failing. Right? So it says that the soldiers then, they compelled Simon to bear his cross. They made Simon do this. That's what it means when they say he was compelled. Soldiers of Rome were allowed to do this. It was a practice called impressment. They could spontaneously enlist the help of any citizen at any time to carry any of their burdens for up to a mile. And it happened all the time. Roman soldiers would have a pack. They wouldn't want to carry it. They carried equipment that was very heavy. I'm told that the packs Roman soldiers carried were oftentimes, guess what? Roughly 100 pounds. So they were carrying heavy burdens around all the time. Nobody likes that. And since I have authority over you, you do it. And they had a law written into their community where they could force you to do it. And they did, and they made a regular practice of it. It was so common, in fact, that it became a matter of routine. So Simon is no more surprised by the fact that he's being forced to carry this than he would have been pleased to do it. He doesn't want to do it, but he ain't surprised that he has to, because it happened all the time. And this being only 650 yards distance, it made it perfectly legal, so he had to carry the cross. And as I say, this was very common. It was actually so common that the Jews would drive stakes into the ground as markers at points that were exactly 1 mile from their home, so that if they were forced to carry something, when impressment was enforced upon them, they'd know exactly when their responsibility ended. They would walk to that stake and then drop their pack and walk away. They weren't interested in doing anything more than meeting the minimum requirement, the bare minimum, okay? They were often compelled to do this, and Simon himself is being compelled to carry this cross for 650 yards. And I'll tell you, if the word compel sounds familiar, it's because Jesus used the same word in Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 41, Jesus said, "Whoever compels you to go 1 mile," he's saying this to his disciples, if somebody compels you to go 1 mile, you go with them 2 miles. You go with them 2 miles. And it's the same word, compel. It was a reference that Jesus was making in that chapter to this Roman impressment. And Jesus is saying, you may find that you're compelled to go 1 mile. Go further than that. Go an extra mile. It will shock the Roman soldiers. They won't know what to do with you. So apparently, by Roman law, the first mile was compulsory. Anything beyond that was voluntary. Anything beyond 1 mile was voluntary. And in their culture, revolutionary. Nobody did that. And Jesus says, you should. So Simon was given a cross to carry, no more than 650 yards away. But we have every reason to believe that Simon's walk with Jesus didn't end there at Golgotha. We have every reason to believe that it didn't end there. In Mark chapter 15, verse 21, this same Simon is mentioned as, quote, the father of Alexander and Rufus, end quote. Who's Alexander and Rufus? Well, we don't know. But the fact that Mark mentions them in his gospel, that Simon is the father of Alexander and Rufus, he's essentially saying, you might not know Simon, but you know Alexander and Rufus. Why would the church know Alexander and Rufus? Because they were prominent in the church. So his boys, Simon had two sons who grew up to become dynamic Christians who get honorable mention in the Bible. And if this is the same Rufus, we have reason to believe, that's mentioned in Romans chapter 16, when Paul makes mention of Rufus, he also, in that same breath, mentions Rufus's mother as a mother in the faith. She was a dynamic Christian woman. So we have every reason to believe that Simon, the husband of that woman, and the father of the two boys, led his family to Christ. It's no stretch of the imagination to suggest that Simon came to faith through this experience of carrying Jesus' crossbeam to the execution site, and that through his salvation led his wife and his children to faith as well. That is the duty and the wonderful privilege of any Christian husband and father, is to see their family following Jesus like they do. Now, I'll tell you, Simon didn't just walk to the site, drop the cross, and leave. This man from Cyrene went the extra mile. He came to faith, and he led others to faith as well. In verse 33, it says, and when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull, they gave Jesus sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he wouldn't. What is that? Sour wine mixed with gall or mixed with myrrh. I think that another gospel says it's just some kind of a concoction that would have served as a narcotic. It was simply meant to reduce the pain of crucifixion. Now, if that catches you funny, it should. Because you remember, these guys were trying to inflict upon their victims maximum pain. I don't know if you know this, but crucifixion was specially designed to administer the greatest amount of pain that could be physically, psychologically administered to a criminal that they could have designed. I mean, they went to great lengths to figure out how to torture the best. Why would they give him a narcotic? To undo what they were trying so hard to accomplish? To produce the pain and then take it away? That doesn't make any sense at all. But I will tell you here that it doesn't specify who gave him the sour wine. It just says they. Somebody gave him sour wine, but we know that it wasn't the soldiers. They weren't trying to minimize the pain. They were trying to maximize it. Jewish sources give us a glimpse into who this might have been, because there is one widely recognized source, a credible record, that tells us that the ladies in Jerusalem, it was very common, would have a goal of becoming a virtuous woman in their own right, according to Proverbs 31. Before I go any further, I'll tell you that it's not uncommon for a Christian woman to seek to achieve that virtuosity that's described in Proverbs 31. How many of you have ever heard, I want to be a Proverbs 31 woman? You ever, a Proverbs 31 woman? You want to be a Proverbs 31 woman? And if you're unfamiliar with the passage, the ideal woman is described in Proverbs 31. So women, if you want to be at the top of your Christian game, read that chapter and seek to be like that woman. Men, if you're single and looking for a wife, find one that conforms to Proverbs 31. You'll be doing well if you can find one. But I think the chapter begins with the phrase, a virtuous woman who can find. They're hard to find. I got one. The rest of you are on your own. But these women in Jerusalem would seek to be a Proverbs 31 woman, like many women do and did. And what they would do is offer this sedative to those being executed in keeping with what it said in Proverbs 31. Verses 6 and 7 says, quote, give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more, end quote. So this was regular practice. All the gals would come around and they'd mix this drink and they would offer it to the suffering, and they would, in that way, fulfill, at least in part, Proverbs 31. Jesus, however, was given that and he refused to drink it. This narcotic, this sedative to take away the pain. Why did he refuse to drink it? The most reasonable explanation was that he intended to receive the wrath of God in full measure. Fully conscious, fully aware of it. This is what he came to do. He wasn't going to dull it. So painkillers were off the menu. He knew God wanted him to suffer, then he was going to suffer. And so he's ready to embrace that, as we see when he rejects the sour wine. In verse 35, it says, then they crucified him. Then they crucified him. If we just stop there, there's so much in that phrase that we could go on about this, you know, for days. Books and books upon books have been written about this, and sermons upon sermons have been preached about the crucifixion of Christ. I don't know what more I can tell you that needs to be said, but crucifixion was terrible. It was a method of execution that was reserved for the absolute worst of criminals, which would have been, in their culture, murderers in particular, and specifically those that were of threat to national security. Okay, insurrectionists, terrorists, that kind of thing. So these are the criminals of criminals. And again, crucifixion was designed specifically to be supremely painful, painful above and beyond any other form of torture or execution, and as degrading as possible. So again, nakedness and nudity and mockery and all the rest was part and parcel to the crucifixion process. It was also highly publicized. Again, Jesus is there in front of 600. That's before he even gets crucified. Now he's out in the open. They would crucify individuals along the public highways, and they would line the roads with crosses so that wherever anybody went, they could see these people dying and dead. They would leave them up there to rot. And this is very highly publicized so as to serve as a crime deterrent. I mean, obviously, if you're in that community and you're seeing these death row inmates up there for days and days, and you can smell the rotting flesh, and you can see how embarrassing it would be, obviously, you're going to think twice about murdering or stealing or, you know, committing the crime of choice. And so it was a crime deterrent, but I want us to pause at this moment to recognize the fact that Jesus wasn't deterred. And Jesus grew up in that community, and Jesus would have seen crucifixion victims, and Jesus knew from the beginning that that was his lot, that he would one day end up on a cross. Jesus wasn't stupid. He was aware of what was coming. He knew prophecy. He knew how this was going to end. And Jesus wasn't deterred at all. He saw how they were stripped naked and how embarrassing they looked. He saw how they were whipped to hamburger. He saw how they were screaming and writhing in pain and how they'd shatter their legs and how they'd stick spears into their lungs and stuff like that. He wasn't deterred at all. Because Jesus was on a mission to save the human race. And the men in whose hands the responsibility for crucifixion had been entrusted were experts in their field. They knew how to make you squirm. They knew how to strike fear into you before crucifixion and during. These guys were experts, and yet Jesus was undeterred. Now, all of these details, and again, I could go on and on, and all Matthew says is they crucified him. Preachers have lost their breath when it comes to this issue. Authors have run out of ink writing about the crucifixion. And all Matthew says is, they crucified him. In fact, you're going to find as strikingly abbreviated an account in the other Gospels as well. They don't go into great detail. There's nothing in them about the dislocated shoulders that we've all heard about, or the lungs filling up with fluid that we've probably heard about, or about how the median nerve would have been crushed by the spike that was driven through the wrist on either side, which would have paralyzed the hand and felt like somebody taking your funny bone nerve with a pair of pliers and squeezing it until it's crushed and twisting it around and pulling it out. You ever smacked your funny bone and your whole half of hand goes numb? You ever done that? It's not funny. They should call it the feels like hell bone, not the funny bone. I don't know if they call it in other countries, but we call it the funny bone. That's just the stupidest thing. You smack it and everything just goes hot and numb. So you can imagine the pain. But Matthew doesn't even mention spikes. They don't even mention the nails. They just say that Jesus got crucified. Now, why is that? Why is there such a glaring lack of detail in the gospel accounts when it comes to the crucifixion of Christ? I believe it's because it was so common. Tons of people got crucified. They say that by the time of Christ, there had been 30,000 executions by crucifixion in Israel. And again, all very public. When we execute somebody in America, it's done behind closed doors. We don't even know what's happening. You have to Google it to find any statistics on this. But for them, they all knew. It happened all the time, and they had the details. Matthew is writing to people, and his original audience already knew what was involved when it came to crucifixion. They knew how much it hurt because they heard the screams. They didn't need to be told that the whipping and the scourging would sometimes leave bowels hanging out because, unfortunately, when they went to the grocery store, they saw bowels hanging out. They didn't need to be reminded, and they probably preferred that they weren't reminded. They had all the reminders that they needed. So Matthew doesn't say anything about it, and he didn't need to. So Jesus was crucified, and they divided his garments, and they cast lots. Means they rolled dice, they gambled to see who got to keep the garments. This was common practice. The soldiers would get to keep whatever belonged to the crucified victim. So sandals, garments, all the rest, they gambled for it. And in their doing, it actually fulfilled a prophecy which was spoken in Psalm 22 when it said, they divided my garments among them and for my clothing they cast lots. Again, Jesus wasn't unaware of his fate and it surprised most people except for God. And sitting down in verse 36, they kept watch over him there just to make sure that nobody would attempt a rescue. And I guess people find it entertaining, honestly. And I know it's shameful. We don't want to admit it. So when I say that human death and suffering is entertaining, we all want to hang our heads and just kind of go, oh yeah, no, people find that entertaining. We do. You watch our movies, you watch people getting shot, you got to wonder how many people have you seen shot in the face on movies in the last 5 years. And we think nothing of it. It's entertainment. We pay money to watch people suffer. Okay? So they sit down to watch and we go, oh, that's horrible. It was probably fun. Probably one way to pass the afternoon with a little entertainment. Okay? They already found it extremely entertaining when they mocked him and put the robe on and smacked him. This is a fun time. This may have been for many that year, best Passover ever. Best Passover ever. That was crazy. Do you see what they did to the middle guy? The guy with the crown on? That was insane. Everybody's talking about this. Only some were disappointed. In verse 37, it says they put up over his head the accusation written against him. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. And now, they're gambling for his clothes. They're hanging him up on the cross. By the way, his clothes are off again. They're gambling for them now. So there he is, conceivably naked. I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. I wasn't there. I don't know if he's wearing clothes or not. I'm thinking that it's more probable that he was naked than that he had clothes on. And I'm saying that because thanks to painters and artists along the way, they have so misrepresented the picture that they always put clothes on him. Let me see one where he's buck naked. And let me see one where you can't tell it's a person. That would be more accurate. I remember when The Passion came out, that movie about Mel Gibson did this movie about the crucifixion of Christ. I remember when that movie came out, there were some Christians that were like, this is just awful. This is just, that's too much. No, that was too tame because I could still tell it was Jim Caviezel, the actor. I could still tell it was him. I could still tell it was a man. I could still tell it was a person. Fact is, this is a very grisly sight to be looking up there at the cross. The Bible says Jesus has now become sin up there. There is nothing cute about Christ on a cross once you see it for what it is. We got pretty little crucifixes, you know. We can buy them. It's merchandise. It's Jesus gracefully positioned on a cross with the loincloth and the forlorn stare on his face with the drop of blood from the thorn, the tiny gap in his side from the spear, and maybe a little blood over here on the wrist. I'm sorry, that's just awful. Jesus represents sin on the cross. It should look ugly. I don't think we can make it look ugly enough, because if Jesus became sin, we should be looking at Jesus on the cross with absolute horror. If, in fact, we see sin as horrible. Look at Jesus like we should look at sin. When our sin is stripped down to the barest element like Jesus was on the cross, it's ugly. When you can see sin for what it really is, it's revolting, it's gruesome, it's shocking, and it's embarrassing that we ever worshiped it in the first place. We should, I believe, if we only felt as ashamed and afraid to admit our relationship to sin as the disciples were to admit their relationship to Jesus, then we'd be on the right track. We should look at our sin up there and go, I'm ashamed to admit that I ever worshiped that sin. I'm embarrassed to even be associated with it. We should be as abhorred by and as distant from our sin as the disciples were from Jesus on that day. Because Jesus is up there as the representative of sin. He didn't just take your sins, he became sin. So I'm telling you, Jesus was ugly. Jesus was terrible. He was awful to look at. And yet, that's our Savior. He took our sin. In verse 38, it says that there were two robbers also crucified with him, one on the right, the other on the left. That's why in pictures you'll oftentimes see a big cross in the middle with two smaller crosses flanking on either side. We know that there was two individuals that were crucified with Jesus that day, so he wasn't alone. Jesus wasn't the only one crucified. These two individuals on the right and the left were probably the accomplices of Barabbas. You remember Barabbas from last week? He didn't work alone. I think it was in the book of Mark where we're told that he had accomplices. And Barabbas was released. And he was probably the ringleader of their insurrection. And I'll bet you that all three of them were meant to be crucified that day at the same time. And Barabbas was supposed to be the one on the middle cross. But since Jesus took his place, it's Jesus on the middle cross. And the other two are there with him. So he's being crucified with as if he were part of that insurrection. He's being crucified with those other two thieves, those other two murderers, as if he himself was a thief and a murderer. And that's a fulfillment of prophecy too, because in Isaiah 53, verse 12, it says, quote, Jesus was numbered with the transgressors. He was numbered, he was counted among the sinners. And so there's the one thief in the number one spot, there's another thief in the number three spot, and here's number two spot is occupied by none other than Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Go figure. He was numbered among the transgressors. In verse 39, it says that those who passed by blasphemed him. They blasphemed him, and they wagged their heads. They just shook their heads in disgust, and they said stuff like, oh, you who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Save yourself. If you're the Son of God, then you come down from the cross. Oh, you're not? Then you aren't. They just shook their heads. Oh, get real. Get real. Destroy the temple and build them. Get off the cross then. Taunting him, mocking him. Likewise, the chief priests also, they mocked with the scribes and elders, and they said stuff like, oh, he saved others, and he can't save himself. Go figure. If he's the king of Israel, then let him now come down from the cross, and then we'll believe in him. If he's our king, then get down here, and then we'll give you homage that you deserve. In verse 43, he trusted in God. He trusted in God? Then let God deliver him right now if he'll have him. Because Jesus said, I'm the Son of God. That's just all taunts, all mockery. In verse 40, it says, in verse 44, it says, even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. So they're getting in on the action. It's taunting Jesus just like everybody else is. So everybody in the community has joined in the chorus of mockery. They're all singing the same song now in unison. Everyone from the lower middle class passerby to the chief priests and scribes and elders. Everyone from the Syrian soldiers and the Roman guards all the way down to the death row convicts on either side of the cross. So that's all to say that there is no strata in human society that doesn't bury their head in the sand as to what the cross of Christ implies. It bothers everybody. It bothers everybody to look up there. Everyone, the Bible says, is offended by the cross of Christ. Galatians 5:11, if you're looking for a reference, everyone is offended by the cross of Christ. And get this, did you notice? There's three that are being crucified, and no one's offended by the cross of either robber. They're not taunting them guys. They're not walking past the foot of their cross wagging their heads. It's Jesus. Nobody's mocking the murderers. Nobody's mocking the robbers. 1 Corinthians 1:23 says that Christ crucified is the real scandal. It's his cross that offends. His cross was the only one that day that people found so offensive. You know why? Because the fact is, you should be up there, and so should I. We know instinctively, intuitively, that that should be us, and that there's something wrong about him being up there. This ain't right. But our conscience won't let us absorb that reality. And so everybody from the top down wags their heads and tries to make excuses for why it is the way that it is and why I've chosen sin over Christ. And everybody knows it should be me up there. Because Jesus' death on the cross speaks to us. And it doesn't just say, hey, I love you enough to do this. It does. Jesus' death on the cross is his way of saying, hey, I love you enough to do this for you. But there's more to it. Not only does it say, I love you enough to do this, it also asks, do you love me enough to do the same? When we look at Jesus on the cross, we know it's a demonstration of his love for us. But we also know that it calls us to show our love for him. Regardless of the cost. You have to understand that when Jesus died on the cross, he wasn't just saving your life. He was setting an example. He wasn't just saving you so that you could live. He was showing you how to die. He's giving us an example. What this is, this grisly sight of this hamburger man hanging from a cross, what that is what real love looks like. We have so tidied up love and made it so pretty. We celebrate it on February 14th with candy, chocolates, pink, red, and white, pretty colors, and Valentine's cards. I'm sorry, that's not what real love looks like. That's cheap Hallmark imitation. What real love looks like is what we would have seen had we been there and looked up at the cross in the middle. It didn't look good. And Jesus is calling us to real love. And we all intuitively know it. What is real love? If it's not Hallmark cards and chocolates, then what is real love? Real love, Jesus says, is laying down your life for your friends. It means dying, if you have to, for the people that you love. But we, I'm sorry, are naturally resistant to that, aren't we? We'll give ourselves to each other a little bit here and there, but to go that far in relationship that it costs me, that's a tall order. And God says, if you do that for me, then that is true love. And so these people that are at the foot of Christ's cross wagging their heads, they know intuitively that Jesus is up there because he loves God so much. That's the only reason Jesus would let himself go through that. They know he's innocent. They know they've got no charges on him. They all know the Pharisees are doing this out of jealousy. They know it's a sham trial. They know it's unjust. And they know the real reason is because that man loves God. And they all want Jesus, literally, to just take his Christianity down a notch. That man's love for God puts mine to such shame that I wish that man would just take his Christianity down a notch. Literally, get off the cross. Get down, get down, get down. That's what they keep taunting him. Get down, get down. They wish he would. It'd make them feel better about themselves and their own lousy performance. But I tell you, their conscience will not let them rest. They know they should love God more than they do. And they're probably starting to realize that they just nailed him to a cross because they hated him. The Roman soldiers would realize this. We'll get to that part next week. They're going to realize that they just crucified the Son of God. Where would you rather be this morning? Up there with Jesus on the cross, or safe and comfortable on the ground? We have a choice. We can either love God and sacrifice our life to him. And I'm not saying that Jesus is going to, you know, following Christ is going to get you killed. I'm not saying that it's going to do this or that. I'm only saying that you're going to be challenged. It's just some way, shape, or form, a multiplicity of times. As you follow Christ, you're going to come up against great challenges, and it's going to require great sacrifices, things that at least in your mind feel great. He's going to ask you to do things that you didn't want to do, or he's going to make you let go of things that you really wanted to keep. It's going to be difficult, and in some respects, it's going to feel like you're being ripped apart. But that's a choice you get to make. You can either be up there with Christ and live a life of love toward God that shreds you to bits, or you can stand at the foot of the cross where it's warm and comfortable, and you can wag your head too. The Apostle Paul had that choice to make. He had to decide, do I get to get up there with cross or Jesus on the cross, or am I going to stay down where it's comfortable? And this is what he wrote in Philippians chapter 3. He says, for God's sake, I've discarded everything else. I made my choice. For God's sake, I've discarded, I count it all as garbage. Why? So that I could gain Christ and become one with him. He's saying, I want to be on the cross with him. I want to be where Christ is. I made that choice. It's where I'm going. He says, I want to know Christ and experience the mighty power that raised him from the dead. He goes, I want to suffer with him. I want to be up there with him on the cross, not down here where it's comfortable. I want to, he says, share in his death, so that one way or another, I'll experience resurrection from the dead. And then Paul says in Philippians 3, dear brothers and sisters, this is me and you. Dear brothers and sisters, pattern your lives after mine, because I have told you often before, and I say it again, even with tears in my eyes, that there are many whose conduct proves that they are really enemies of the cross of Christ. Paul goes, I'm not an enemy of the cross. I've climbed up it. I've nailed myself to it. I'm up there with Christ. I'm suffering, and I want to die with him. Why? Because I love him, and I want to be one with him. And I want to see what this resurrection bit is all about. And he says, but the truth is, and I say this with tears, there are many in the church who oppose that idea. They're enemies, truly, of the cross of Christ. That's the part of Christianity that they don't like. We all like to think that Jesus was the last and the only to crawl up on a cross and die. Truth is, he's called all Christians to follow him there. You know this. Jesus said it even while he was alive. Unless you forsake everything, you can't follow me. You have to be ready to be let go of anything that gets in the way of me and you. This is the only way, Christian. And we have made it, Christianity, into something that it was never meant to be. So that we have literally done to the Christian faith what the Roman soldiers did to Jesus long ago. We've butchered it beyond recognition. We don't even know what Christianity is anymore. Our version of it, at least in my country, it's soft and palatable, and comfortable, warm, tolerable. Jesus called us to something greater. He called us to love. And if we love God, we ought to ask ourselves this morning, have I given him everything that he's asked? Am I truly following Christ? Because refusing to accept crucifixion as a natural part of the Christian experience makes you an enemy of the cross. It makes you the mocker in the story. It makes you a tyrant. A tyrant. Refusing to love God in a way that puts you up onto the cross only leaves you at the foot of someone else's who loves God more than you, who is willing to go the extra mile for his Lord, who is willing to allow their love for Jesus to wreck their life, rearrange it entirely. If you won't follow Christ, then you'll be at the foot of someone else's cross, wagging your own head, trying to find excuses for why you're still down here and not up there where you belong. We're to follow Christ to the very end, to love God with all of our heart, mind, body, and soul. And I'll tell you this, those that do have no regrets. I can assure you, Jesus has no regrets. Was that a bad day for Jesus? Yeah, sure it was. That was no fun. But does he have any regrets? Absolutely not. Nor does any Christian who has ever followed Jesus to the very end of the road. Those who have regrets are those who don't. Don't let that happen to you. Follow Christ this morning. Follow Christ all the way to Golgotha. See where it takes you. Again, I'm not saying that you're going to get killed, but I'm also not promising that you won't. I don't know. I will tell you that the journey is at the very least exciting. If you can stomach the journey. Can you handle pain? Can you handle sticks and stones and broken bones? Can you endure the insults and the taunts and the mockery and the broken heart that'll come with it? Can you push through and remain faithful? Jesus Christ has a spirit that he's willing to put inside of you, which will enable you to do so. To acquire that spirit, you must have faith in the one who gives it. Do you believe in Jesus this morning? Do you believe in Jesus Christ? Because if not, good luck following him. It won't happen. But by the power of God, it can.